Okay, so this is what we did last time. We imposed that condition of metricity, and the argument for it was to say that we know there are coordinates in which the first derivative of the metric will vanish at any given point. It makes sense to require that the geometrical part of the connection also vanishes in those coordinates, so that covariant derivatives are the same as ordinary derivatives in these locally flat coordinates. Now, what do I mean by the geometrical part of the connection? That is the symmetrical part of gamma. Okay, so that's this guy. This is the geometrical part, and I'll give you a couple of reasons why this is part. So let's call that the geometrical part of the connection. The first reason is that the antisymmetric part of gamma is a tensor anyway. Okay, so it sort of has an independent existence. It's a tensor, or its existence doesn't particularly relate to the derivative. It's not forced to be there for any reason. It can be there, cannot be there. And that, so the torsion is just an independent tensor. In many theories, it is there, but there's no, we can't make it zero. And so, if it's a tensor and it's not zero, we can't make it zero. So, forget about it. The geometrical part of the connection is the symmetric part. Okay? And just to remind you, I lowered these indices, right? So, gamma alpha beta is gamma, is g gamma mu alpha beta. Okay? So, I'm talking about these two indices. When we symmetrize on those two indices, that's the geometrical part. There's another way of looking at it, which is that the geodesic equation, you know, when you vary the action for when you vary the length of a world line and you extremize it, the geodesic equation tells you the Christoffel symbol comes in, okay, which is automatically symmetric. However, there's another definition of geodesic, which is orthoparallel, which is you say that the vector pointing along a curve should be, as you take the covariant derivative of that vector, it should be parallel to the curve. That's called orthoparallel. We may have time to do that a bit later. This definition and the geodesic definition coincide if the symmetric part of the connection is the Christoffel symbol. Okay, so it's a condition only involving the symmetric part of the connection, not the torsion. So that's another reason to call the symmetrical part the geometrical part of the connection. So we went through this little bit of algebra. The torsion does come in into these two terms. And then I added the antisymmetric part of the connection to get this formula. Okay, so this is obtained just by adding 1/2 of t gamma beta alpha. Okay, just this term. This combination is called a contorsion. And so the statement is that the connection equals the Christoffel symbol, okay, that metricity implies that the connection equals the Christoffel symbol plus the contortion, actually plus 1/2 the contortion. And the final statement I made is if the torsion is totally antisymmetric, if this tensor happens to be antisymmetric under exchange of any two indices, then the contortion tensor equals the torsion tensor. And I'll now give you some examples of theories where this is the case. Let's just show that. You see, if this, the way I organized this was deliberately, the torsion by definition is antisymmetric under these two indices. So I flipped these two indices and got the minus sign. And now you see, if this guy is totally antisymmetric, well, that means if I put push the beta to the end, okay, I flip it past the alpha, I get a minus sign. And I flip it past the gamma, I get another minus sign. So it means that this guy is plus that guy. So these two will cancel. Okay, if the torsion is totally antisymmetric, these two cancel. And now let's look at this term. Well, if it's totally antisymmetric, then let's see, beta, alpha, gamma. Then I flip the gamma past the beta, I get a minus sign. And I flip the gamma past the alpha, I get another minus sign. So this, if torsion is totally antisymmetric, this equals T beta alpha gamma. Okay? And therefore, the contortion, which is this stuff in the brackets, equals the torsion. Okay? So it's just a little bit of algebra. That's a very special case of the contortion being totally antisymmetric. Let's just mention some examples. Einstein plus fermion. And I'll give you some references later to this when we do variational principles for gravity. But basically, the action for Einstein is the Ricci scalar over 16 pi g. Don't worry if none of this is familiar. For the fermion is I d slash psi. This is some kind of covariant derivative. Again, a derivative involving a connection. And what you end up with this is this was worked out by Kibble and others in 1960, around 1960. And what you end up with is that the torsion is proportional to psi bar gamma, and then totally anti-symmetrized, mu nu rho psi. Let me do it this way. Gamma mu, gamma nu, gamma rho, anti-symmetrized on those three indices. So it just turned, and this thing is called a spin current. There is no analogous term for gauge fields like the electromagnetism or for scalar fields. There is no such term which arises. It's purely a fermionic effect. And you find that in the very simplest theory of gravity coupled to a fermion, you get this, you get a totally antisymmetric torsion. And therefore, you're in this situation which I described. Another example, which is particularly interesting at the moment, is that supergravity, n equals 1 supergravity, it's the simplest supergravity in four dimensions. It has some nice finiteness properties compared to ordinary gravity, ordinary Einstein gravity. And what it consists of is Einstein plus a Rarita-Schwinger field. And a Rarita-Schwinger field is a spin 3/2 field. So it has one vector index and one spinner index. Again, don't worry if this sounds unfamiliar. You will learn about spinners later in the Psi program. And so in this case, you find that the torsion is proportional to psi mu, psi bar mu, gamma nu, psi rho. And it is not totally antisymmetric. Okay, so both of these equations for the torsion follow from the variational principle. You vary the action with respect to all the fields, and this is what you find. So you just have to live with it. What it means is that the straight geometrical interpretation of the theory doesn't really hold. And there's always this tension in general relativity between viewing it as a nice coincidence that the equations of gravity describe a geometry, or saying it's fundamental, that the world is a four geometry and somehow geometrical principles are at the heart of everything. Okay, so people who study general relativity like to believe that. People who study particle physics believe, oh, well, it's just another field theory, and the geometrical picture is just an interpretation. And certainly the geometrical picture is quite hard to maintain, given that you're going to quantize the geometry, because then it means that actually there are many different geometries in quantum superposition at the same time, and so there's no single geometry anyway. And so should you take the geometrical picture of the universe seriously or not, or just say it's a convenient approximation. Okay, so I wanted to tell you a little bit more about, let's take this geometrical point of view for a moment. It's always useful to look at different points of views. So the geometrical meaning of the covariant derivative. Okay, so the way in which we described it was very algebraic. You know, we just said we're allowed to make coordinate transformations. We want the derivative to transform as a tensor. It didn't really give us any picture of why we had to add this connection term. And so you can obtain a nice picture as follows. Let's imagine embed curved space in a flat Euclidean space. Or Minkowskian, doesn't really matter for this calculation. Okay, so let's imagine just taking our curved space and embed it in a flat space of much higher dimension. And there's a couple of theorems here. Locally, any smooth manifold MD, okay, so a manifold is just a curved space with some dimension D, meaning there are D independent directions at each point in the space, that can be embedded in R D D plus 1 over 2. And so if D equals 4, you can embed any four-dimensional manifold locally in a 10-dimensional flat space. Okay, and roughly speaking, it's because there are 10 components of the metric in four dimensions. Globally, any compact manifold MD can be embedded in R to the D over 2, 3D plus 11. Okay, which is a very bizarre result. That's a result due to Nash. John Nash is the star of the film A Beautiful Mind, and this was his contribution to Riemannian geometry, was to say how big a space do I need to embed any manifold, compact manifold, with globally, and that's the theorem. So you can always do this. You can take any curved space-time and stick it into a flat space of much higher dimension. Yes?
Embedded means that the metric induced on this manifold will be
Euclidean, yes. So you start from the, I'm just going to do that. So when you embed it, what do you do? Okay, so you take this curved space. You've got some coordinates, A. These A go from 1 up to the embedding dimension. Okay, so this space is just flat. So imagine it's flat. It's a multi-dimensional space. And I just put my surface or my manifold, d-dimensional manifold, inside it. This is now a function of the, so let's do these as capital X's. These are the coordinates on the flat space. These are the coordinates on the manifold. These go from 1 up to d. And the surface is described that way, that any point on the manifold is assigned some coordinate in the embedding space. Okay, so I just have to find these functions. Maybe let's call it E. So I've got E functions. I've got E functions of 4 coordinates in the case of embedding a 4-dimensional manifold. Now, the tangent vectors to the manifold, they just tell you what are the actual vectors in the embedding space, right? Some vector pointing in the direction of this of the manifold. So to find those out, I just differentiate these. So I'm going to write it this way. E alpha is capital X comma alpha. Okay, so that's a vector. I've got 4 tangent vectors, right, which give me the 4 directions sitting within the manifold. And I just get them by differentiating the this map from the manifold into the embedding space. Or D, let's call it D. The metric, well, the metric, the distance between 2 points is just dx, dx, right? 2 points separated by a distance dx in the flat space. This is the metric. If it was a Minkowskian space, I'd put an eta in here, okay? I'd use dx transpose eta dx. Let's not worry about that. So this is equal to x a comma alpha x a comma beta dx alpha dx beta. Okay, and therefore this is the metric. This is G alpha beta. This is called the induced metric on MD. Okay, so the induced metric is just obtained directly from this embedding map. Equals E A alpha E A beta. Sorry? A? Capital A. Sorry, that's capital A. So there are capital A. Capital A is the index, and it goes from 1 to E, where E is the embedding dimension. Okay, so this is the metric on the curved space, and it's just given by the product of the tangent vectors. Now, it's obvious that any vector in the tangent space can be expressed as a sum of the E alpha. Right, there are four vectors, and we've got a four-dimensional space. So any vector in that space can be expressed as a linear combination of the E alpha, e.g. The some vector, if it is tangent to the surface, will be V mu E mu. And the V mu are the four components of the vector. Components, the d-dimensional components. Components, and now it's fairly obvious that if I change coordinates on my manifold, change these x's, obviously the e's are going to change, and obviously the coordinates v are going to change. Now, if we take this vector and differentiate it, with respect to x alpha, then we get the following, the d alpha v. So v is really the geometrical thing. This is literally a vector sitting in that Euclidean space. And now we're going to differentiate it with respect to the coordinates x. This is d alpha v, v mu e mu. Sorry. Plus v mu d alpha e mu. Okay, so this is the naive part, just saying that because v depends on x, when we differentiate it, we get it, the partial derivative. But this part is the change in the basis vector for the tangent space e mu. Okay, change in the tangent vector. Now this tangent vector, the change in the tangent vector, e mu, can be expressed as, so this is some vector in the Euclidean space. It has some component which lies within the surface, gamma lambda mu alpha e lambda. This is within the tangent space. To MD. And then there's some other component. There's a part of it that is not in that tangent space. And this is normal, some vector. This is the this is normal. Now let me just understand. Okay, so what we do now is, so this is a unit normal. And so what we do now is we say gamma lambda mu alpha is equal to, just take the inner product of this with the e's, and um, In fact, I don't need to really go any further. I don't need to go any further. So the ordinary derivative of V involves this derivative of the tangent vector. Part of the derivative is within the tangent space. Part of it is normal to the manifold. And so now we construct the covariant derivative. We just project out the components normal to the tangent space of MD. Okay, in other words, the definition of the covariant derivative was we just project this out. Just ignore it. So you had some vector which is moving along, you differentiate it, you find the change in the vector, part of the change is in the surface, part of it is out of the surface, you just project out the part that sticks out of the surface. You project out this term, and the covariant derivative of our vector is equal to the ordinary derivative of the components plus gamma mu alpha lambda. Got it wrong around. Mu lambda v lambda e mu. Okay, so from this point of view, this is the definition of gamma. And you can notice a couple of things about it. You see E mu was the derivative of X. So this is obviously X comma mu alpha. And therefore, this object is symmetrical under exchanging mu and alpha. Okay, and so gamma is automatically symmetric under exchanging mu and alpha. So there's no torsion. If this is your definition of covariant derivative, there is no torsion. And so very often we will use differential geometry and the notion of a metric to do calculations of surfaces embedded in R3, let's say, or R4. For example, we can do all of vector calculus in spherical or cylindrical or any other coordinates we like just by using this GR formalism. Whenever you do that, there's never any torsion, okay? Because you're considering some space embedded in flat space, and the connection is automatically symmetric. By definition, it's symmetric under exchanging these two indices. Okay, any questions? Yeah. K turns out to be, we won't really need to worry about it. It's something, okay? From this argument, it's just the part of the derivatives of the tangent vectors which are sticking out of the surface. Okay, I'm not going to dwell on it. But it turns out that K does have a geometrical meaning, and it's called the extrinsic curvature, zic curvature of the surface. And it's also called the second fundamental form. So I guess Gauss and Riemann understood that when you have a curved surface, there are two aspects of that. One of those aspects is that it's intrinsically curved, that you can define this gamma which is defined only with reference to the tangent space of the manifold, and that describes the intrinsic curvature. This k depends on how the space is embedded in the surrounding space, and it's called the extrinsic curvature. In cosmology, actually, the Hubble constant, you've probably heard of the Hubble constant, expansion rate of the universe. This is the extrinsic curvature of how space, which is three-dimensional, is embedded in space-time. It describes the expansion of the universe. So it's really a physical thing, but it only really applies when you have a space embedded in a bigger space. Okay, so hopefully that's a little bit of insight into connections.
Is it going with the metric here?
Sorry?
Is it going with the metric here?
Yeah.
I think this last time we had E, shouldn't you all, you should still have the dx alpha and dx beta, right? So the index of, so the alpha and beta indices aren't free anymore.
Sorry, here?
Yeah, the very below that. I think you should still have the dx, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I was...
okay, but also, what about the A indices? Like, on the DL squared, does it have any indices on
it? Yes, it does. Well, I'm writing X either as a vector or as XA. It's really the same thing. Okay. I mean, I can write a vector as a vector, or I can give its indices. Just remember, it lives in this embedding space. Okay? So I write it in both forms. Here it's in vector notation, here it's in index notation. That formula for the E, so E A alpha is X A comma alpha, etc. Okay. Yeah.
In gauge feed theories, we also have covariant derivatives, right?
Yes.
Are those torsion free?
Yeah, that's a good question. It works in a different way. You see, what's different in GR is the connection involves space-time. And it's there in order to make space-time derivatives into tensor objects. In gauge theory, the invariance is a bit different. Okay, so in gauge theory, maybe the simplest case is you have an object which might be a wave function or a field, a complex field, and the invariance is the phase of that field. Okay, psi of x. So there's no differentiating going on in the. In the transformation rule. You see, this would be the analog is that we had... Let me just continue here. So if I have a field which changes by phasing, at every space-time point, there's some independent phase I can assign to the field. The idea is that the whole theory is invariant under this. And now you want to take derivatives, so you try this... derivative, and you let's say this is psi prime of x. D mu of psi prime is, of course, I d mu theta plus, let's see how I should write it, psi, let's write it this way, e to the I theta, I d mu theta, plus d mu times psi. Okay, so basically when I pull this derivative through the phase, I get this extra term. And so this derivative does not transform correctly. Okay, so what do I do to correct that? I say, oh, well, I should have changed my definition of the derivative to d mu plus I a mu. Okay, so this is called d mu, covariant derivative. And this is now the new covariant derivative. So over here, I'm going to have plus I A mu prime plus D mu psi. Okay, and what I'll say is that A mu prime plus D mu theta is by definition A mu. So the connection transforms in just such a way as to cancel this bad term. So all of this is I A mu. And so now this is equal to e to the I theta D mu psi. So this is D mu prime psi prime is just a phase times D mu psi. So we introduce this connection A mu. All right, now, I mean, it's very different than gamma. It only has one index. Gamma has three indices. It's not clear what you would mean by torsion for a vector. But this is how it transforms. So like gamma, we say this A mu doesn't really mean anything independent of the coordinate system. I mean, when you work out gamma, it's not a tensor. It's not the same in all coordinate systems. It changes between coordinate systems. Likewise, A. And so A is certainly not a physical thing. It's very far from physical. You can change it with the gauge transformation. It includes many unphysical degrees of freedom, which you can remove with the gauge transformation. There's nothing like torsion when it comes to A just because of the number of indices. Now, having said that, there is actually, when I describe these results, if you look at Kibble's paper, and I'll give you the reference if you're interested, it's a very beautiful paper. What Kibble's notion was is that general relativity is the gauge theory of the Poincaré group. So you know in the most general symmetry of the Minkowski metric are Poincaré transformations. We proved that, right? Now, if you say that these Poincaré transformations are global transformations, just x prime equals lambda x plus a, this is Poincaré. If you say instead you want to make it into a gauge theory, you want to gauge this group, then it turns out you get very close to general relativity. You can view general relativity. This is a kind of a particle physicist's way of looking at general relativity. You take the Poincaré group, and you make the group parameters local functions of x, much like here, and you turn it into a gauge theory, and then the gauged Poincaré group gives you gravitation. And it has a gauge field. This A mu turns out to be the what's called a spin connection in gravity. And so there is actually a fairly close relationship between gravity. But it would take us quite a long way to then see what is the connection between the torsion and the connection in a gauge theory. Any other questions? Okay. Yeah.
To understand geometry in terms of gauge theory of the Poincaré group, or is this theory interpreting the gravity in terms of curved space-time, or is it based on the flat?
It's based on flat. Because the only justification for the Poincaré group is that it's the symmetry of flat space-time. So now there's some actually very powerful results. So for example, if you take 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity, not 3 plus 1, it's not a very rich theory because it doesn't have any gravitational waves. The gravity gets coupled to the matter very tightly, and there's no additional propagating degrees of freedom. But in 2 plus 1 gravity, if you formulate it this way as a gauge theory, which I haven't explained, but if you formulate it as a gauge theory of the Poincaré group, and you do perturbation theory and compute Feynman diagrams, you can prove it's finite. No infinities at all in 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum gravity, just done perturbatively around flat space. So that's a pretty powerful result that surprised a lot of people when it was discovered about 20 years ago. And it says that that formulation is pretty decent, the formulation of gravity as a gauge theory. So there's sort of this continuing rivalry between, let's say, traditional GR people who want to say geometry is geometry and, you know, don't mess with geometry. And then particle physicists, and Steven Weinberg's book is a great example. You see, Steven Weinberg came in to study gravity, and he said, oh, gravity is just a spin 2 particle. And it couples to other particles, as it has to. And he showed some very powerful results on the S matrix of these spin 2 gravitons, which actually are required by energy and momentum conservation in the infrared. And they result precisely in Einstein's theory of gravity. When you sum up all the diagrams from this particle physics point of view, you get exactly Einstein's theory. So, you know, from his point of view, the fact it turns into this geometrical theory is kind of an accident. The fundamental point of view is of particles living in flat space. And, you know, then that's very paradoxical because space is not flat. Space is only locally flat. The universe began in the singularity. It definitely wasn't flat. So I would say there's no really satisfactory resolution of this debate as yet. My view is both points of view are obviously wrong. The geometrical point of view is obviously wrong because the universe began in a singularity. There are singularities in black holes. The straight particle physics point of view is obviously wrong because the universe is not flat space. And S matrix is not fundamental in the universe. I mean, if you just have an S matrix, you can't really explain at the state of our universe why the Earth is orbiting the sun and all of these things. So I think people are still struggling with the right picture of what quantum gravity should be. And that will come back and tell you whether this geometrical picture has any fundamental validity at all. But I think most people within I don't want to say anymore. Yeah.
What's the importance of assuming a flat embedding space in that derivation? Where is it?
Just to give you a picture, nothing more.
Could it have been any other space?
Any other space, anything. The only real point of this is that you had an embedding space which has its own metric. In this case, the metric was just delta AB in the flat space, the Euclidean metric. Any other space which... I'd have to think some more about this, but I believe any embedding space which has no torsion itself is not going to give you torsion when you define the covariant derivative this way. If you just differentiate and project into the space, I don't think you're going to get any torsion. But I'm not sure about that. Yeah. Well, they don't. It's true they don't. But as I said, the only justification for focusing on the Poincaré group is it's the symmetry group of flat space.
It's a very strict analogy to electrodynamics, right? Because you can think about F mu as the curvature of the U1 group.
That's right.
Just like our space-time curvature is the curvature of the Lorentz group, for example.
You can.
Or the torsion is the curvature of the translations.
Mm-hmm.
In that same sense. So if you start with a Klein-Gordon field, for example, and you couple it to U1,
mm-hmm.
and you make it U1 invariant locally,
mm-hmm.
then you get electrodynamics for free. So we had F mu equals 0 before, but all of a sudden you have non-vanishing F mu because you have electrodynamics.
Right.
And in the same sense, you get gravity out of it if you start with Minkowski space. Right?
I guess so. I mean, I think you're right that it's fine just to somehow assert that the Poincaré group is fundamental.
Yeah.
And if I... one way of saying it is that if I have a metric which respects the Poincaré group, like flat space, then the fundamental symmetry, this Poincaré symmetry, is unbroken. But if I have a metric which doesn't respect it, then you say it's spontaneously broken, right? Then you say, I've got a space-time which happens not to respect the fundamental symmetry. And that's fine too. But the assertion is just a little, you know, why the Poincaré group? So, sure.
Well, he used the word curvature, but when we are using...
Connections do have curvatures.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's something I haven't got to yet. In fact, we're going to do it right now. So whenever I have a connection, I have a corresponding curvature. Okay, and we'll see that. And then we'll see that the curvature I get relates to the curvature I described earlier. The curvature I described earlier was the fact that I could always pick coordinates such that up to second order, the metric was flat space. And those second order terms encode the curvature. And we're going to see exactly how. Okay, so very, very good question. But before I do that, the upshot is of the above to define derivatives. We need a connection. Now, having told you that, I want to tell you a few cases where you don't need a connection. Okay? There are important exceptions. Okay, the first one is for totally antisymmetric tensors. And these are also called differential forms. Okay, so it turns out that for totally antisymmetric tensors, the covariant derivative equals the ordinary derivative. And so the connection just cancels. So an example, f mu nu. Okay, so how would I define the field strength if I'm in general relativity? Well, I would try to define it this way in terms of the gauge potential. Okay, so I take ordinary electrodynamics in special relativity, and I try to generalize it, and I take these derivatives, but they better be covariant so that this is a tensor. So I write this down. Well, if you just work this out, it's d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. And then the first connection gives me a minus gamma mu alpha nu a alpha, right? So you always get a 1 minus gamma for a lower, differentiating a lower index. And the second one gives me a plus gamma alpha nu mu a alpha. And what you notice is that if the torsion is 0, then the last two terms cancel, okay, because the gamma is symmetric. And so this is equal to d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. So when you have no torsion, then the covariant, the anti-symmetrized covariant derivative is equal to the anti-symmetrized ordinary derivative. Likewise, you can check that d mu f nu lambda, and these square brackets means that I anti-symmetrize with respect to these indices. So there are 6 permutations. I write down all 6 permutations. The even ones get a plus, the odd ones get a minus. I put a 1/6 out the front. That's what this means. And likewise, this equals to d mu f nu lambda, anti-symmetrized. Okay, so in a world of anti-symmetric tensors, where all I do is take derivatives and take the anti-symmetric piece, then actually the connection disappears from all formulae. So that's what makes differential forms so nice. And differential forms are related to topological properties of manifolds, which really don't depend on the metric at all. And so this is kind of how this plays out, is that you define these objects that don't depend on the connection, then you write down various integrals and so on, which encode topological properties of the manifold, and neither the metric nor the connection appear. Another special case is what's called the Lie derivative. Okay, so a Lie derivative, so given a contravariant vector field P mu, so this would, you know, this is P mu is some function of x, and Q mu, I define the Lie derivative with respect to P of Q to be the obvious thing. You see, if I've got a vector and I want to differentiate Q along the vector, I form the quantity P mu d mu. Right? This would be the derivative in the direction of this vector. So that's the naive thing. This is not a tensor. Sorry, let's do covariant here. This is the naive derivative along the vector. But because P mu is changing, you have to correct this in the following way. D mu P nu. And this is the correction term. So that's the definition of the Lie derivative. I take the derivative along P, and I subtract off the derivative of P dotted into the vector. And the reason why this is so nice is actually this is exactly the same as the ordinary derivative. Okay, so the connection terms cancel. Again, if the torsion is zero. Up to torsion terms. So that's the Lie derivative. And you can see that, you see here I have a connection with a plus sign. The covariant derivative of Q, because it has an upstairs index, will give me a plus gamma. Likewise, here I have a plus gamma, and these two gammas cancel if the torsion is zero. And I'll tell you the sort of the meaning of the Lie derivative in a moment. But you can just take it for now as a fact of algebra that the connection term cancels. So likewise, the Lie derivative of P of a covariant vector is P mu d mu. P mu d mu q plus q mu d mu p mu. And So in this way, in this case, it works slightly differently, that this term will give you a minus gamma, because it's a derivative on a lowered index object. This will give you a plus gamma, and these two will cancel. P mu d mu q nu plus q mu d nu p mu if gamma mu alpha beta equals gamma mu beta alpha, i.e. t equals zero. The Lie derivative on a scalar involves no connection. P mu d mu phi. There are no indices on a scalar, and so there's no connection term anyway. The Lie derivative on a tensor, let's take some symmetric tensor. In fact, any tensor, S. And so this would be, again, the sort of naive term. And then some correction terms, mu beta d alpha p mu, and plus S alpha mu d beta p mu. So again, you just take derivatives of the p and contract them with the original tensor, and etc. And it's equally true that the right-hand side is the same as the right-hand side with no, with ordinary derivatives, with no connections. So one interesting case is the Lie derivative of the metric e.g. LP of G. And so this would be P mu D mu G alpha beta plus D alpha P beta plus D beta P alpha. Okay, why is that true? It's true because, well, in fact, and this term is zero, using metricity, which is that d mu g alpha beta equals zero. So why is this true? You see, if this S was really g, then obviously this term is zero because of metricity, right? Here, the derivative of S is zero, and so I can pull the S inside under the derivative. Okay, so this term here is actually equal to d alpha g mu beta p mu because the derivative of g is zero under metricity. And so this is equal to d alpha g. D alpha p beta. Okay, etc. And so the Lie derivative of the metric is just the symmetric derivative, covariant derivative of the vector p. The meaning of the Lie derivative, it is the change in the functional form of the metric or a tensor in general under the corresponding coordinate transformation. If x prime mu is x mu plus epsilon p mu, okay, so then I have my vector field. I can use my vector field to define some coordinate transformation. I can do the coordinate transformation on G, and I can work out what is G prime, alpha, beta, as a function of its argument. And the Lie derivative turns out to be, so delta sub p of G alpha, beta is equal to epsilon LP G alpha beta is equal to G prime alpha beta of X minus G alpha beta of X. So it's a sort of, it's an interesting thing. If I take G alpha beta of X and I change coordinates, I get some new g of x prime. And if you just think about it as a function, it's a different function of its arguments than the original g was of x. Okay, and the change in the functional form is this expression. The I take the new function of the same argument, okay, minus the original function of that argument, and that gives the change in functional form. And that's what this Lie derivative is. And so you can tell that when I do variational principles, this Lie derivative is going to be quite interesting because it actually changes the functional form of the metric. So maybe we'll see some of that a little later. Okay, so now we're going to do curvature, as I promised, and see how curvature is related to the connection. From the connection to curvature. Now, the basic observation is that in flat space, we have that partial derivatives commute. Okay, it doesn't matter which order I take derivatives in with respect to space-time coordinates because partial derivatives commute. But these covariant derivatives do not commute. In a curved space, in curved space-time, okay, and essentially because you have to differentiate this connection. So let's work concretely. D mu, d nu, acting on some covariant vector, S rho, minus d nu, d mu, acting on S rho. So in flat space time, this expression would be 0. But in a curved space, this is not zero. And by definition, this is the Riemann tensor, rho mu nu s sigma. So Riemann's discovery in constructing his tensor is when you commute these derivatives, the answer doesn't depend on derivatives at all. There's no derivative of S here. Okay? The answer is just some matrix multiplying S. Okay, for any S, this is for all S. And this makes it analogous in Yang-Mills theory, or gauge theory, Yang-Mills. We have d mu is equal to d mu plus I a mu, where this is the connection, and d mu d nu equals I d mu a nu minus d nu a mu equals I f mu nu. Okay, so the field strength in electromagnetism emerges as the commutator between covariant derivatives. And here the Riemann curvature is the commutator in covariant derivatives. There are some differences between gravity and a gauge theory. In a gauge theory, the action will be minus 1/4 f mu nu f mu nu. Have you done this already? You did this already, okay? So in a gauge theory, you take this curvature and square it, and that gives you the Lagrangian density. In gravity, we don't. We take the curvature to one power, and we do various contractions on it, and that's the action density. So there's some profound differences between the way gravity and gauge theory work. In gravity, you sort of have more options in terms of constructing an action density, and that is used in the Einstein theory of gravity. Okay, so let's see this explicitly. Let's calculate. So explicitly, we need to calculate this. So we take the ordinary derivative of the covariant derivative minus gamma rho nu sigma s sigma. Okay, so just by habit, I always leave the derivative index last, contract the covariant index, and leave the same free index. So that's this term. And now I've got to add the connection term that comes along with this derivative, gamma mu nu rho d alpha s rho minus gamma rho alpha gamma s, sorry, that's sigma. Sigma. Okay, so these two terms are the first. So these two terms are just that first term. And, there's one more, in fact, because these have two indices, right? So I need two gammas when I take the covariant derivative. There's one more term, minus gamma mu rho alpha d nu s alpha minus gamma alpha nu sigma s sigma. Okay, so that's only half of it. Now I've got the second term, but second term's easy because I just flip mu and nu. Okay, so it's equal to that minus the same thing with mu and nu exchanged. So let's assume torsion is zero. So gamma is symmetrical. And then lots of these terms cancel. Okay, so in particular, this one is going to cancel, because if gamma is symmetric, when I subtract off the result for mu exchanged with nu, this whole term is going to cancel. Right, so this cancels. This term is going to cancel because it's symmetrical under the mu and nu. So this cancels. And there's more. You see, if I examine this term and that term, you will notice that the derivative on S in this term cancels the derivative on S in that term. Why? Because when I differentiate this S with respect to mu, right, I have exactly this term, but with nu exchanged with mu. And yes, so the combination is symmetric under mu goes to nu. And now I'm going to subtract off the change of mu to nu. So anything symmetric, when I subtract off the same thing, is going to give 0. So let's just note that. So the ds term is symmetric, mu to nu, so cancels. Okay, so now we have the main result, because we have that all the derivatives of S canceled. Second order derivatives canceled, because they were symmetric. First order derivatives canceled because of this nice playoff between the different terms. And so what we're left with is something quite simple. I think, let me continue on this board. Okay. Say again?
You get other terms.
You get lots of other terms.
Including derivatives of S.
It's a good question. I don't think so. I don't think so. I think the derivative of S terms still cancel, even if the torsion is not zero. What happens is you get a new expression for the Riemann curvature, which involves derivatives of the connection plus bits involving the torsion. But I believe it's true that these cancel even if you have no torsion. Of course, you need to, you see here I used torsion being zero to cancel this gamma. It's not obvious this is going to cancel. I believe it still does. But I'll tell you next time. Okay, so what are we left with? We're left with the derivative of gamma term from that first piece, d mu gamma sigma rho nu, s sigma. Okay, and then we come through here. I think we've got this second, that's gone. We've got this term, the minus gamma term. We've still got that. So plus gamma rho mu alpha gamma alpha nu sigma s sigma. Okay, plus, just make it clear, that's not differentiating the s, plus minus mu to nu. And that, by definition, is the Riemann tensor minus the Riemann tensor rho mu nu s sigma. So now we can read off the Riemann tensor r sigma rho mu nu is equal to d mu gamma rho nu sigma minus d nu gamma sigma rho mu minus gamma alpha rho mu gamma sigma alpha nu plus gamma alpha rho nu gamma sigma alpha mu. So So, rather amazingly, we've got this formula that even though gamma wasn't a tensor, we know that Riemann is a tensor. Okay, this funny combination of gamma and derivatives of gamma is a tensor. Why? Because the defining equation is tensorial. Is a tensor. Okay, so because I know that the right-hand side is a tensor, by definition, okay, the right-hand side was defined up there to equal the commutator of derivatives times s. It must be that the left-hand side is a tensor. This is true for all s, and so now we can use the quotient theorem I described earlier. So if something, if an object contracted with a vector is a tensor for arbitrary vector, then the object itself must be a tensor. Now, let's calculate this. So it's interesting to calculate in a locally flat coordinate system. In which gamma vanishes. Okay, so I can always choose coordinates in which the first derivative of the metric is zero, therefore gamma is zero, once I've assumed torsion is zero. And so in this coordinate system, all of these terms will vanish, because all of the gammas are zero, but these terms are not zero. And so let's work them out. D mu of gamma sigma rho nu is equal to 1/2 g sigma lambda d mu of g rho lambda nu plus g nu lambda rho minus g rho nu comma lambda. Okay, so I did a tricky thing there. I pulled this derivative through the metric upstairs. Why? Because the derivative of g was zero. Okay, and so I'm allowed to just pull derivatives through g, providing I'm just calculating this in a coordinate system in which a g is a constant. But you see, it depends on second derivatives of the metric, which I can't set zero, and so let's now lower the index, the sigma index, and write out the result for r, sigma rho mu nu, by this guy and this subtracting that. And what we find, g nu sigma comma rho mu minus g rho nu comma sigma mu minus g mu sigma comma rho nu plus g rho mu comma sigma nu. Okay, so in a locally flat coordinate system, the Riemann tensor is just related to second derivatives of the metric. So let's quickly summarize the symmetry properties of this object, R. From that formula for R in the flat coordinate system, we can read off various symmetries. And you see, the thing about symmetries is if they hold in one coordinate system, they have to hold in all coordinate systems. Why? Because the statement of a symmetry is a covariant statement. So let's say I know that F alpha beta is minus F alpha beta in some particular coordinate system. Now I do the coordinate transformation to a general coordinate system, still true, because all F just changes by these Jacobian matrices, right, which are don't affect the symmetry properties at all. Okay, so if a symmetry is true in one coordinate system, it's true in any coordinate system. And the symmetries you can see in this locally flat coordinate system are the following. One, R sigma rho mu nu equals R mu nu sigma rho. What have I done? I've taken this pair and this pair and interchanged them. Okay, so interchange, or let's say exchange first and second pair of indices. Okay, and I'll just leave it to you to check that that's true. If I just write down R mu nu sigma rho, write down this expression, you can check that it's identical to R sigma rho mu nu. Secondly, so this is a symmetry. It's symmetric under exchange of the pairs. It is antisymmetric under this kind of exchange, R sigma rho mu nu. If I just exchange first and second, is R rho sigma mu nu. So it's antisymmetric in each pair. Okay, so if I exchange the first and the second, I get a minus sign. And similarly, exchanging the third and fourth, okay, so if I exchange these two, it's also, this is by definition, because R was defined to be the commutator of these two derivatives, and the third and fourth indices are the derivative indices over here, right? So this mu nu is the third and fourth. So by definition, R was antisymmetric under this exchange. It turns out it's antisymmetric under the other two as well. And the third identity is that it has cyclicity under the last three indices. Okay, meaning that R sigma rho mu nu, if I do a cycle of the last three indices, R sigma nu rho mu plus R sigma mu nu rho. Okay, so what I'm doing here is I'm taking the nu to the front position and shunting rho and mu down. And then I'm taking mu to the second slot and shunting nu and rho down. And this combination is zero. This is a result of the Jacobi identity. D mu comma d nu d lambda plus d lambda d mu d nu plus d nu d lambda d mu equals zero. So in any associative algebra, you expect this identity to be true. It is true. You can just write out all the terms, and they all cancel. And that has the consequence that this Riemann tensor plus cycles is zero. So now we can count the number of components. and compare with our previous arguments. So the number of components taking 1 and 2 into account. Well, I just think of the Riemann tensor as a, you see, if I take this number 2 into account, it's telling me it's anti-symmetric under these pairs, rho nu. So think of the pairs as indices. And each pair takes d minus 1 over 2 values because it's anti-symmetric. And then I've got to symmetrize on the first pair and the second pair. And so what I get is 1 half d minus 1 over 2 multiplied by d minus 1 over 2 plus 1. Okay, because the number of components of a symmetric tensor is just, if it has n indices, would be 1 half n plus 1. In this case, the n is the number of pairs of indices, and it's d minus 1 over 2. And so this is equal to 1 eighth d minus 1 d squared minus d plus 2. Now, we've got to take 3 into account, but 3 is totally anti-symmetric. Using 1 and 2. So let's say it this way, the left-hand side of 3. LHS of 3. So you can check that if I take the left-hand side of 3 and I use 1 and 2, then if I permute any of these two indices, totally anti-symmetric under exchange of the four indices of all four indices, okay, then so you can check that. I don't know any simple way to see it other than to check it. And so this tells you that there are the number of extra equations are the number of anti-symmetric, number of components of a totally anti-symmetric four-index tensor, which is just this, additional constraints. Okay, so 3 represents this many additional constraints. So the number of independent components components of R of the Riemann tensor is 1 eighth d minus 1 d squared minus d plus 2 minus 1/24 d minus 1, d minus 2, d minus 3. And if you work that out, that is equal to d squared over 12, d squared minus 1. And these are exactly the number of second derivatives of g of g which cannot be set zero by coordinate transformations. Okay, so when we calculated before, just using coordinate transformations, we realized we couldn't set all the second derivatives to be zero. It turns out this tensor, the Riemann tensor, encodes precisely those terms. Okay, I better stop there. Sorry I went on too long. You didn't shut me up halfway through. Yes. Okay, any questions? So we've basically covered all the math we're going to do, I think. And so now we're going to switch to the Einstein equations. We've done all the work. We will see, following all this work, that the Einstein equations are almost totally unique. That Einstein's theory of gravity was really amazing, and that it didn't introduce any new parameters into physics at all. It's a theory of gravity. It just took Newton's constant and reinterpreted it. Didn't introduce any other parameters. Used the speed of light from special relativity. And so with no new parameters at all, but just a reinterpretation of gravity, there came out a whole number of predictions. From the existence of black holes to the expansion of the universe to all kinds of other experimental tests which have been done and which verify that this is the way gravity works. So it's really a sort of gold standard of theoretical physics. You know, if only we could make a unified theory which didn't have any more parameters than the ones we've already measured, we would be very, very pleased. But currently we're not doing too well, because typically our attempts at unification introduce hundreds of more parameters, or thousands, or 10 to the 500. So we're not doing as well as Einstein did. Any questions? When's the example class? This afternoon. Yeah, phew, okay. You're working. What is it about?
Geodesic
equation?
The Keating vectors.
And Keating vectors. Okay, very good. So, you see, implicit in what I said, I didn't prove it, that the Keating vector, the Lie derivative, I didn't prove it, but the Lie derivative represents a change in functional form of the metric.
No, you will.
They will do. Okay, good. So, in particular, you know, if I write the metric of a sphere down, for example, it's independent of the azimuthal angle. You know, you take the sphere and you rotate it, obviously it's symmetrical. If you write it down in spherical polar coordinates, you see that it doesn't, the metric, the Gij, doesn't involve phi at all. And so if you transform phi, that's a Keating vector, and the metric doesn't change. There's no change in the functional form of G induced by changing phi. And that's immediately indicates there must be a Keating vector, which corresponds to this azimuthal symmetry. Yeah?
If the torsion is not vanishing, is the Riemann tensor can also still interpret it as a curvature?
It is. I mean, this definition is still given. Even if the torsion is, I think it's true. We need to check that. I think it's still true that we use this definition. I'll tell you next time. But actually, maybe not. Well, you see, there was this one nasty term, which I didn't, there was this term, Okay. So this term only canceled because the torsion was zero. So it might be I need additional derivatives of S on the right-hand side. I'll tell you next time. Any other questions?
Often make analogy between the gauge theory and the gravity. And
yes.
We still use the term connection, curvature in gauge theory, but all those words come from the differential geometry, but I cannot really see the differential geometry in gauge theory structures. So
okay. Yeah, in gauge theories, you're not talking about the geometry of space-time. You're talking about the geometry of what's called a fiber bundle. So the picture is that at every space-time point, I have this group living. In general, it'll be some non-abelian group. So it's a G group element, which is a function of X. So you sort of think about a bigger space where I have, locally I have space-time, so four-dimensional space, and then I have these fibers, which are the G of X. This is the space-time. And when you talk about the curvature, it's really the curvature on this fiber bundle. Okay, so it's a kind of higher dimensional picture. It's a higher dimensional picture. So the Riemannian curvature is just the curvature on space-time. But we know there are other spaces in the world. In particular, in QCD or electro weak theory, there's these internal phases which rotate, for example, an electron into a neutrino. And they're very physical things. They rotate. The electro weak theory says an electron neutrino are actually identical. They're just related by a phase at a fundamental level. This is before spontaneous symmetry breaking. And those phases are these fibers. And now you work out the curvature on this bigger picture, which is a fiber bundle, and that's what the electroweak field strength is. So in fact, Kaluza-Klein theory, which is a very pretty theory, probably wrong, but a very pretty theory, says that these internal symmetries arise as space-time symmetries of some real extra dimension. You see, so say I have Riemann curvature, of not four dimensions, but five dimensions. And imagine the fifth dimension is a little circle. Okay, so now I have some extra symmetries. I can do coordinate transformations in that fifth dimension. Those coordinate transformations turn out to be the gauge transformations. Exactly the gauge transformations. Like it's a very pretty picture. And it turns out the Einstein action in five dimension, when you reduce to four dimensions, gives you Einstein in four, plus Maxwell, just for free, because this was discovered in the 1920s. And so it's a very pretty theory, but it's also quite sort of ugly in the sense it says that there's this curled up extra dimension, which we can't see, and somehow stabilized itself. Not clear how it stabilized itself. And this is the sort of geometrical picture which people try to build of string theory. It was in some ways inspired by the Kaluza-Klein picture. But as I say, there are many reasons why it doesn't quite work.